So this week I thought I'd talk a little bit about working with reflective thought skillfully. I think next week I'm going to be giving a series of talks on working with fear. And we'll have a forgiveness talk as well. So some good stuff coming up. Reflective thought is basically the analytical thought that we add on after an experience occurs. Trying to figure out what the fuck it all meant. A little bit like the police who actually don't really hardly ever show up when a crime's actually committed. They come up afterwards and try to figure out, I guess, what's happened. Who's to blame? What went wrong? What's going on? That's reflective thought. What the fuck is happening here? Why did this happen? What am I going to do? How do I avoid this ever happening again? So it's basically that ability of the mind to analyze the situation and to try to figure out, give it a meaning, walk away with a lesson, an interpretation. Of course, it's no surprise that this faculty, the Buddha said on many occasions, creates some of the greatest suffering. The Buddha referred to it as when it's unchecked as papancha, and also vachi sankara, and it basically means the unchecked thinking that becomes obsessive. And he actually broke it down into 7 anusayas of different types of obsession that we all have. And I'll talk a little bit about the general types. But it's interesting that the Buddha's lists are very, very similar to the lists that clinical psychologists have come for what they say are cognitive distortions, that type of thinking that causes unnecessary suffering in our lives. And in fact, a great amount of the work in cognitive behavioral therapy and clinical psychology is working with people, helping them think in a skillful way that is useful but doesn't cause obsession or depression or needless anxiety, worry, despair. And it's no surprise that there's so much addiction in this world because basically alcohol, in case you don't know, it's just basically neural inhibitors in a can or in a bottle, which means it turns off your frontal lobe. It basically shuts down all that self-conscious, self-aware, endless chatter. And they don't like me. Why did I say that? What's going on here? I want to be funny right now. But so, you know, that sort of that endless self-aware chatter, which locates itself in the ventral medial and the axis of the brain, and also in Broca's and Wernicke's region of the frontal lobe, where we basically create endless chatter about ourselves. What are other people thinking about me? What's going to happen to me? Oh shit, I'm not going to have enough money. Oh fuck, why did I do that? That kind of stuff. So we have the capability of falling into chatter that causes stress and suffering. And some of this type fall into basic categories, like, for example, I'm going to use, for example, a new job. You get a new job. God forbid, but you're employed. So you have a new job, and you have that first day. And so there's overgeneralization. So you go into the first day. You don't know anybody. Everything's new. You don't know what the fuck's going on. Holy shit, why did I take this job? And you generalize, and the mind says, oh, it'll always be this way. I'll always be overwhelmed. I'll always be the new person. I'll always have people looking at me funny. I always won't know what everybody's name is. Sort of projecting a temporary state into the future. That's called overgeneralizing. Then there's black and white thinking, which is, oh, shit, I quit my last job. I have to stay in this job. Or, oh shit, this job really sucks, I've got to quit it and go back to my old, and that's the only thinking. There's no other, like, well, maybe I'll give it a shot, stay here for a few more weeks and see what it feels like then. It's either I've got to quit or I'm stuck here for the rest of my life. And then there's, of course, personalizing, which is taking everything as if it's only happening to us. I'm the only one who knows what this feels like. Oh, shit, I'm a fraud. They're going to see through me at this job. Only I get freaked out by new jobs. Taking everything as if it's just about us and nobody else can understand, and I'm the only one who feels this way. So that's called personalizing. There's catastrophizing, which is, oh shit, this is the worst decision I've ever made in my life. This is totally fucked. Only seeing the bad outcome. Yeah, this is really bad. I can't believe I did this. I'm never going to be able to do this job. I'm going to be fired, and then I'll wind up homeless on the streets where I'll be killed. So I've risked my life by taking this job. There's another one that let's see. There's another one that I like. We hit a lot of them. Oh yeah, overemphasizing the importance of a decision. So suppose you're in the job and you don't like it, and you're caught. Like whether to stay or leave or change the conditions of the job, but you're really freaked out about it because, like, this is my job. Holy shit. This is the most important thing in my life. Well, it's actually not. You know, the stuff we do to make a living is not the most important thing. What's more important is, you know, acting in skillful ways, not causing harm, taking care of ourselves, bonding with others, having a support group. These are important things. You know, whether or not we stay in a job or not is not. But we tend to overemphasize the importance of decisions and situations and thus paralyze ourselves and make it much more difficult to come to a conclusion. So these kinds of thinking, especially the taking things personally or assuming things will always be this way, overemphasizing the importance, tend to create an incredible amount of papancha, or obsessive thought. And there's an enormous amount of cortisol and stressors that are released by the amygdala when we get into the situation, and we can create a great deal of discomfort for ourselves. And it takes a toll on people's ability to sleep and be present. The more we get caught up in obsessive thought, the less we are aware of the body. The body becomes more and more stressed and tight. The digestion is affected. People have been shown to age quickly because when there's a lot of cortisol present, it stops effective cell growth and leads to all kinds of damage. And continual stress also leads, they think now, to an attack on the neural sheaths of the hippocampus, which causes Alzheimer's disease. It's bad stuff, okay? You don't want to be caught up in continuous, unchecked thinking for the sake of thinking, because it's bad news. Not to mention it makes us really self-conscious and stifled, and we lack spontaneity. We lose our sense of humor. When we're around people, we're not present with them. We're lost in this self-conscious thought of fear, worry, projections, trying to figure out what it all means. So before I talk about the kinds of skillful thought, because the Buddha actually listed quite a number of skillful ways of thinking, I'm going to first talk about where thought fits into the process. Because it's not just what or how we think, it's when we think that's really important to get a hold on thinking skillfully, reflectively, analytically, using our ability to think as a benefit. As the great Ajahn Chah said, if The spiritual life was just sitting and meditating, and there wasn't any thinking to it, then chickens would be enlightened. But they're not. If you're a member of PETA, which is great, but don't take that as an insult, chickens are not enlightened. They deserve to live, but they're not enlightened. So, we do need to think. And yet, you know, we experience so much suffering as a result of unchecked, obsessive thought at times in our life. Worry, panic, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen in the future? What do other people think about me? Why are you looking at me that way, fella? Etc. That we come to spiritual practice sort of hoping that it'll give us a complete respite from thought, and that, well, you know, maybe this will be the place where I can completely learn how to shut off the thinking valve. And, you know, good luck with that, because there's no such thing as a brain that doesn't, a human mind that doesn't think. So the key is to do it skillfully as part of, to develop good habits with how and when we add our tendency to analyze situations into the mix. Now, the Buddha was very clear. He said when each new situation in life happens, the first thing to do is to check in with the body rather than to immediately rush in with thought and try to figure out what it all means. And we all tend to do that when we've had a fight with somebody, when we've had a disappointing experience, like we want to get in the subway and it's all packed and we can't get in and we're late and holy shit, why do I live here? This is terrible. This sucks. I hate all of you. Get off of my train. You know, you fucking yuppies. I lived here before you did. Yeah. I've never thought that. That's the Williamsburg Bedford stop thought. For those of us who've been there many, many years. If we come into soon with thought, we generally, when we've just had an experience that's difficult, trying, like a new job, there's a lot of emotion present. There's a lot of stress in the body. And if we try to simply think skillfully, it won't happen, because what's happened is we've flooded the brain with adrenaline and cortisol and dopamine, and we're looking, you know, we're in this place of defensiveness or outrage or anger, and at that point the frontal lobe is completely flooded, and it's just going to be at the behest of the most unskillful parts of the brain in terms of figuring things out, which is basically the amygdala. So at that point, what we want to do when we've just had a difficult situation in life is bring the awareness into the body and feel what's present, feel what's there. Often if we like feel really hurt, it'll be a sensation in the stomach. If we feel outraged, it'll be tense muscles, like how dare you, or a locked jaw. If there's a feeling of loneliness, it might be in the chest. So we go into the body and we feel what's present, and we allow the sensations rather than to be blocked off. Because in life, what happens generally when we feel these emotions is we tend to want to distract ourselves. We want to get angry and just think, oh, about that external trigger. We want to think, oh, I just want to fuck these people up or whatever. And that's a way to divert ourselves from feeling what's going on internally. So what instead we stay with the feeling. And we just watch as the muscles contract and get tight. And we stay with them and we watch them as they flow. And we give them the awareness that they do. This is how we honor our feelings and our emotional experience. We go to it first and we allow it to arise. We don't immediately go to, I'm going to fix this anger or, that kind of like, I'm in charge here type thinking. We just stay with the body. And we stay with it as the sensations arise and they flood through us. And then eventually we bring the breath and we begin to calm down so that we breathe while we're not trying to get rid of the feelings, but we're breathing and we're slowly beginning to extend the out-breath so that we're beginning to integrate the breath into these feelings. And over a period of time, these feelings will arise and then they'll subside. It's really important to always go first to the breath, the body, and even note the mind itself. Just how claustrophobic is the mind aware of all the senses around me? Is the mind aware of the feeling of the contact with the chair? Am I aware of the breath? Am I hearing? Am I present? This keeps us from falling into these thoughts about figuring it all out. There's an old Chinese proverb that goes, if you hold a leaf up to your eye, that leaf can seem bigger than the moon. And what that means is that if you hold a problem up and you only think about that problem and you're not aware of anything else, that problem can seem more important than anything else. The people on the L train who are blocking the door and not getting on the subway can seem to be the worst thing that ever fucking happened, because we're holding it too close. And so by feeling the feelings, allowing them to arise, not jumping in too quickly with analytical thought, keeping awareness bigger than the problem that we've just encountered, we're giving a sense of perspective, so that we're basically pulling the leaf away from our eye, and the leaf's getting smaller, and we're beginning to see how big it really is in comparison with everything else. So when we do this, we're aware that the analytical solution or the problem-solving mind is not the entirety of working through an experience. Feeling, breathing, cultivating calm, these are just as important as adding in that analytical thought. And we cannot, the habit of immediately going into trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to take away from this? This always disables all these other critical faculties of feeling, of checking in somatically with how the body reacts to each situation, of using the breath. So it's also really important when thoughts arise to be very suspicious of them. As the Buddha said in the great Kalama Sutta, don't believe what you've been told. Don't believe anything you've heard. Don't believe anything that's been passed around as common sense or anything that you've heard quoted from good books or you've even heard me say. Don't believe it. Don't believe the hype, as Public Enemy used to say. It's my favorite rap critic. So there, you have to listen to that. When a thought arises, we basically regard it with, okay, this is maybe something I should listen to, but maybe not. And this is hard to do, because very often in our life, most of the thoughts we have and most of the functional situations are useful. You know, it's like you wake up, you're like, oh, I gotta take a shower. Okay, where did I put the towel? Oh, there's the towel. Where's the soap? Oh, yeah, I better run the water for a while so I can get warm. I mean, these are useful thoughts, right? So 99% of the time we're using our thoughts. Oh, look, the light's red. I better stop. We're using our thoughts and they're helping us. So to suddenly remember, hey, wait a second, I'm not inclined or forced to believe every thought requires some skill, because we have a tendency to believe what pops into our mind, and this is a problem. There's a great book by the neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux called The Emotional Brain, and he spends chapter after chapter coming up with examples of tests where they establish that a great deal of the analytical thought that we bring to a situation is complete nonsense. There's one great test where they flash an image to a person of an abstract thing so quickly that the person doesn't cognitively recognize it, but they do see it unconsciously. Then they show them all these 8 images, and they say, which one do you like the best? And invariably, people will go to the image they've been flashed, because that's the way the brain works. We prefer things we've seen before. So they'll say to the test subjects, well, why did you point to that image? Why did you like that image over all the others? And people will come up with all these amazing reasons. Oh, well, this reminds me of my home. This looks like a map of St. Louis. This one, this is what Picasso would do. The rest of this is all nonsense. And it's just the brain fabricating reason after reason for what we do, why things have happened. And it's almost invariably just a malarkey. There's actually an example they use, neuroscientists use of the monkey on the elephant's back, which is basically, they say that the rational cognitive mind is like a monkey riding on the back of an elephant, and the elephant is actually making all the decisions. But the monkey likes to believe, oh, I'm in charge here, I'm steering this, but the elephant doesn't give a shit. It's just turning left and right. So much of this rationalizing thought is just justifying our impulses, what we want to do. If we've just seen something that's outrageous, we see kids rushing to get a seat in front of an old woman who's frail, and we might have this, oh, this is outrageous, why, I just want to, what's wrong with kids these days, blah, 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 and then we launch into a miniature speech about what's wrong with the world in New York, and blah, 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 blah. And of course we don't do anything, we just sit there. So, and we're just there suffering, we're adding more suffering into the world, and of course it's all chatter. It's all chatter. So we want to be suspicious. We want to regard it and with a sense of doubt. And one of the things we can do is, as each new thought arises, we can see, okay, how does this affect me? Just how does this sit? Is this true? What I just thought. I had a great example of this the other day. A friend of mine just broke up with a woman. Well, she broke up with him. In these days, That's the competition. Nobody wants to be the one who's broken up with. Like half the relationships I know, they're just waiting. Like they want to be the one that breaks up with the other one. So in this case, my friend, he wanted to break up with her, but she said, no, 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 let's not break up. And he's like, okay. And then she broke up with him. So he was, of course, all hurt when he earlier wanted that. Anyway, doesn't matter. But He said, this will teach me from ever dating a redhead. I was like, let's stop. just sit with that thought. How does that thought feel right now? And it's like, pretty fucking stupid. Now, let's sit longer with it. How does it feel now? Okay. Retarded. So, if we don't take time, if we don't surround thoughts with a pause, with a noble silence, and just see how they sit, and ask, oh, is this really true? We tend to immediately build on it. And that's what creates really awful fights, is people build and build and build, and they don't sit, and they don't sit with what they've heard, they don't sit with a statement they've made and see just how does this resonate with me? Is this something that I want to feel, I want to own, that I want to be comfortable with? Instead, we just keep plowing on. Oh, yeah? You said that? Well, wait till you hear what I'm going to say next. And then, you know, it just creates this momentum that spirals out of control. So, that's sort of some of the general rules of, like, when to think. But then the next question is what to think. And basically, the Buddha had some really wonderful suggestions. One great line goes, sabbe sankhara anicca, tiyada, papaya, pasate. And then he goes the same with sabbe, sankhara, dukkha, and then sabbe, dhamma, anatta, tiyada, papaya, pasate. And what this means is that all things that we've experienced are impermanent. They're not going to last. So instead of trying to think to ourselves, oh, it's always going to be this way, reflect with each new situation on how everything we've experienced in life has arisen and passed. So we bring this perspective of everything I've just incurred, it's just a fleeting moment in time that's not going to continuously repeat. And this changes the way we react with things, like when we've been insulted or we've experienced something frustrating, when we remember, oh, this is just a condition that's arising and passing, it changes the way we relate to life. We're simply reacting against something that's not going to happen in the exact same way ever again. It's going to pass, too. And then the Buddha said to remember that almost all of the conditions in the outside world, they're not only are they not lasting, but they're really not reliable. So if we've been expecting this job or this relationship or this project or this creative endeavor, whatever we're doing, if we expect this to be the thing that solves life for us, that brings us lasting happiness, that brings us contentment, that this is the really important thing, then we've already lost perspective. And to remember instead that there are sources of real lasting happiness, but that they come from within. They come from our acts and our actions. They come from not causing harm. The third is not taking anything personally. Nothing that has ever happened in our lives is personal in our experience. The details might be different, but if you look at it simply in terms of the emotions that we feel and what's the basics, the structural basics of our experience, we all experience loss, separation, abandonment, setbacks, disagreements, losses of people we love. It's all the same. None of us have ever experienced anything that's unique or completely individual. We all go through the exact same basic structural story in life. You know, so this taking of situations personally, and especially the feelings that arise and the emotions that arise, oh, nobody knows this feeling, that's not true. There's a great psychologist, Paul Ekman, who did a study, and he found that there's only 8 basic emotions that people have transculturally, transhistorically. We're all working with the same 8 color palette. That's pretty much it. So getting lost in this idea that nobody can understand, or this is all about me, or this is something that I've done wrong, or that this is a cosmic insult, that tends to distort. And instead, if we start with the thought, oh, this is a universal experience, what I've just happened, this is not anything personally, that tends to immediately change the way we relate to experience. The Buddha also talked about asking ourselves, when something's gone wrong, ask ourselves, okay, what can I adjust? There's a tendency when we have a bad interaction to immediately go to pinning the blame on, of course, the other person. Blaming, you know, the people in the subway, blaming the other people in our interactions, blaming, feeling the victim. And the problem with that is even if it's true, we can't control other people, so we don't walk away with any wisdom whatsoever from that. What we do walk away with wisdom is when we say, okay, what actions did I do here that brought about this condition that I can change? Because the only thing I can have any control over is what I do. That's the only part of the mix that I have any sense of authorship, any control over. That's the only thing really to walk away from. Even, for example, suppose it's we get in a fight always with our mother about something. I don't care, whatever it is. Then we can easily blame them, but that doesn't help us. We can instead say, okay, the next conversation I'm going to learn that this is a boundary that I'm not going to transgress. I'm not going to talk about this. It's up to me to say, no, I'm not going to talk about that. This is off limits. Because every time we go there, there's suffering, there's contention, there's conflict. So I own that. That's going to be my action. It's also really useful to bring to mind reflections of skillful people and what they've done in similar situations. An example of this, a teacher of mine used to say, is ask ourselves, what would somebody who is both kind but also fearless, what would that person do in this situation? It's almost invariably not what I would do. But it's a good check. Because I'm, you know, it's like, you know, you ever had that situation where somebody comes to you with a problem that's causing them a complete vexation and they have no ability to sleep, and you immediately see the problem. Why? Because you're not in their life. You're not afraid of what they're afraid of. But the moment we step into all the details and all the, you know, the self-story and the inner biography we carry around, then we get lost in the fear. So if we ask ourselves, okay, you know, what would Samuel Jackson do in this situation? Then you'll know what he would do, and it'll probably be different from what you would do. I like Samuel Jackson. He's a terrific actor. Finally, it's also really important to bring about wisdom of Maranasati, which is basically the wisdom that we are all going to die. And that's actually, it sounds like a depressing bit of thought to add to any situation, but actually, when you do add it, it really brings about perspective really quickly. There's a practice in our tradition called a year to live, where people walk around with practicing as if they've gotten a diagnosis that they have a year to live. And what everybody says is, wow, 90% of the shit that bothered me before I did this falls away. Because if I knew I had a year to live, I would not give a shit about the fact that the L train is full, that somebody's not, you know, being nice to me, that this situation is a bummer, that whatever, because it doesn't matter. But when you think about it, none of us have any guarantee at all. That seems like a good place to stop. So I thank you for listening. I hope that there was something worthwhile tucked in tonight's talk on reflective thinking. Now I'm going to turn off the...